Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, here, as always, with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. All right, Victor, well, we've been of late in the midst of a big push by the Obama administration to sell the Iran deal, both to Congress and by extension to the American people. I want to get to the speech by the president that's caused so much controversy in a moment. But first, how about this? Chuck Schumer, widely considered next in line to be the next Democratic leader in the Senate after Harry Reid retires, has come out against the deal. What do you reckon that augurs? I guess to put a finer point on it, do you reckon that the modern Democratic Party has enough backbone left on foreign affairs to shoot down a deal like this?
I'm not sure, and I don't think people know quite what Schumer was up to. About half the people think he's principled, and the other half feel that he knows it's going to pass anyway, and he's going to appeal to his constituency without hurting the president by voting against it. But this deal is taking on a life of its own. The more that we learn about it and the side agreements, what's in it and what's not in it, if you look at the polls where there's a sizable majority against it, it doesn't look good for the president the longer that it goes out. So there's a snowballing effect that Schumer and other people in the Democratic Party are starting to affect. I don't think Obama had any idea just how ridiculous his speech sounded to most people in the media and government, even the public. Remember, he gave a supposedly a one-hour comprehensive speech on the deal, and then immediately General Soleimani went right to Russia and thought, wow, after listening to that, I don't have to observe a travel ban. I'm going to go buy some weapons. And then his future Senate minority or majority leader said, wow, after listening to that, I'm going to vote against it. So there's something's going on that we're not talking about, but he's not doing a good job selling this thing because it's not a saleable product.
All right. Well, let's turn to the speech in its specifics, and I'm just going to give you some excerpts here, and you can respond as you see fit. We'll treat this as a sort of cheat sheet for people who want to respond to their liberal friends on this topic. The first excerpt here, a substantive claim about the deal. Quote, after 2 years of negotiations, we've achieved a detailed arrangement that permanently prohibits Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. It cuts off all of Iran's pathways to a bomb, close quote. Is that how you read this deal?
No. If it were, I would just go back to what the president said before the negotiations started, that there would be no centrifuges working. There would be no stockpiles of any enriched uranium. There would be anytime, anywhere inspections. And there would be a third party who would examine any uranium outside of the country of Iran. None of that applies. So according to the president's own logic, he's failed.
Here's another excerpt. This is one that's gotten a lot of traction in the press, quoting the president here. Between now and the congressional vote in September, you're going to hear a lot of arguments against this deal backed by tens of millions of dollars in advertising. And if the rhetoric in these ads and the accompanying commentary sounds familiar, it should. For many of the same people who argued for the war in Iraq are now making the case against the Iran nuclear deal. Of course, that doesn't amount to much more than an attempt at guilt by association. But what do you make of the broader argument there?
Two things. One is that what he's basically saying is that I'm afraid that they're going to outspend me, because if when I put Morgan Freeman up on an ad or I go to Washington and rally up all these liberal groups like MoveOn.org and they go after Schumer, that might not be enough because there's just as much money and activism on the other side. And given my Chicago way of looking at the world, what I do is noble and what they do is ignoble. That's one takeaway. The second is a little bit more disturbing. You remember as a candidate, Obama sort of said the same thing. He said, this Iraq war was cooked up by the likes of Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz. Well, why did he pick those two people? I mean, it was really Cheney and Rumsfeld and George W. Bush and Condoleezza Rice. But he picked those two people because they fit the stereotype of a Jewish neoconservative. So when he says the same people who were that were for the Iraq War, I don't think he means, as you hinted, John Kerry, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Thomas Friedman, Fareed Zakaria. He's talking about Jewish shills for Israel. So it's pretty scary, I think, because I think Obama, with a wink and a nod, is telling people that the Israelis and turncoats in America are against the interest of the American people. That doesn't have a good history in the 20th century. So he should really be ashamed of himself. And this is another theme, is that if we take away the word Barack Obama and we just look at who's actually saying these things as an empty slate, by any fair standard in the last 7 years, a lot of the things he's said and done are anti-Semitic, it's racially charged, and yet he seems to get a pass. I hope that discontinues, because it's kind of shameful what he just said.
There's also an interesting coda to that invocation of Iraq, which is the following. Again, a quote. More than a decade later, a decade after the war, we still live with the consequences of the decision to invade Iraq. Today, Iraq remains gripped by sectarian conflict, and the emergence of al-Qaeda in Iraq has now evolved into ISIL, close quote. Okay, Victor, the Iraq war started a dozen years ago. What that statement elides in getting from there to here is that for about half of that period, the president of the United States has been named Barack Obama and not George W. Bush. Yeah. How much of what he's complaining about there is on his shoulders?
All of it. And don't believe me, believe what he said, because in 2011, he said that Iraq was stable and self-reliant and he was going to leave it secure. And his vice president said it could be the greatest achievement of the entire administration's many achievements. So he was looking toward re-election, and he wanted a talking point and said, I got every last troop out. So he did the unthinkable, and he pulled out all the peacekeepers, and the inevitable happened. It would be as if in 1956, Eisenhower's up for re-election. He wants a talking point that we no longer have 80,000 troops in South Korea. So he says, you know what? Harry Truman in 1950 got us into this Korean War, and I'm going to get every single troop out. And if he did, we know we wouldn't have Kia and Samsung today. We'd have North Korea controlling the whole peninsula. And that's what Obama did. He handed over a secure, stable, self-reliant, and greatest achievement to ISIL. And he knows it. And I'm surprised that people haven't called him on it.
How about this line from the speech? Just because Iranian hardliners chant death to America does not mean that's what all Iranians believe, close quote. Okay, there's a couple of different ways we could take this, Victor, but let's try perhaps the more subtle one. For the sake of discussion, let's accept the president's supposition there. Even with that being the case, does it matter?
No, it's irrelevant.
Yeah, this is the argument you get all the time, that Iranians are broadly pro-Western, pro-American. They're not our enemies. They want to be more like us. But even if that's true, is that material if it can't be said about the people who actually wield political power in Tehran?
It's never true of any autocracy. That was a big theme in Britain and France in the late 1930s, that the German people were basically pretty good and that all the indications were they did not want to go in the Tsar land. They did not want the Anschluss. They did not want to go into Czechoslovakia. It didn't matter. If it were true, it would be nice, but it didn't matter whether it's true or false in a dictatorship. I'm sure there's a lot of people in Iran who would like to be friends, and they're sick of theocracy, but they're not going to have a say at all. It won't matter. And Obama, it's doubly ironic, because when they did, to the extent they had any say, was in spring of 2009 when a million of them hit the streets, and Obama sort of shunned them and thought, wow, these are kind of like neocons. I don't want to talk to them. I'd rather talk to the revolutionaries like Ahmadinejad, I guess, because he just simply wrote them off. But he's very adolescent. I don't know where he gets his ideas about history or human nature, but they're puerile. They're really adolescent.
Well, to that point, Victor, here's the money quote. President Obama talking about the most combative elements of the Iranian regime. Quote, it's those hardliners who are most comfortable with the status quo. It's those hardliners chanting death to America who've been most opposed to the deal. They're making common cause with the Republican caucus, close quote. Now, people of our philosophical disposition have spilled a lot of ink and eaten up a lot of airtime over the past 6 years, taking umbrage at various and sundry things that the president has said. But this, though, this crosses some fundamental threshold, doesn't it? I mean, this is the kind of thing that you would expect people who a decade ago were telling us that dissent was patriotic to regard as anathema.
Well, that's what Hillary Clinton said. Remember, when no one attacked her, she said she was going to speak out because dissent was the only thing you could do during the Iraq War. And Obama himself not only voted against the Iraq war. He voted against the surge. He declared the surge a failure. He always opposed the president. And he actually opposed declaring the Quds Force a terrorist force when he was a senator. So he had a lot of dissonant views. The problem with this is it's McCarthyite to the core. And what he's saying is basically the Republican candidates who oppose this deal and the Republicans at large and the majority of the American people and Chuck Schumer, they're all making common cause with Ahmadinejad against people like myself and Khamenei, the supreme leader. So think about it for a second. He's saying that the supreme leader of Iran who supports the deal has more affinities with him than he does with, I don't know, Carly Fiorina or Marco Rubio. So it's kind of scary because he's basically saying members of the democratic consensual government establishment are kindred souls with fascists in Iran, and that somebody like myself and a theocratic fascist in Iran are trying to fight against both sides. Again, the reason he does these things is because he's an adolescent. He's puerile. He has no real education. He's way over his head, and he lashes out with the one assertion that no one's ever going to challenge me on this, because they never challenged me on it before, because they'll be termed racist or illiberal, and I've always been able to get away with this stuff throughout my entire life, and nobody's ever going to call anybody on it because I'm Barack Obama. And take away the name Barack Obama and just examine what he says on the merits, and it's disgusting.
So, final question here. What's better in the long run, by which I mean sort of the broad sweep of history, for President Obama? We know he wants the deal, but is it better objectively in terms of his legacy to have this thing blow up on the launch pad rather than to have to deal with the weight of what happens if it gets executed?
Well, I think he'd be much better off that the deal fell apart, because there would not be a war. There would be an effort by the United States to clamp down on the sanctions even greater. The Iranians couldn't sell their oil. They couldn't buy arms. They'd be in even greater duress, and they would give greater concessions, and those concessions would be more likely to stop them becoming nuclear. If this deal goes through, he's going to enjoy the same reputation that Stanley Baldwin and Neville Chamberlain had 3 or 4 years later, when people called them the guilty men because they had laid the foundations of appeasement. Because somebody's going to say, how did Iran get this bomb, and how did Iran touch off a nuclear arms race with Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait in the Middle East, and how did we end up being closer to the Iranians than we are to the Israelis? Ah, it had to be Barack Obama. He was the one who created it, who implemented it, and was proud and bragged about it. And that's not going to be a good legacy for him. And so he should be hoping that people prevent him from getting his own way.
All right. That's all the time we have for today. Join us next week for the next installment of the Classicist podcast. And in the meantime, stop by hoover.org, where you can read all of Professor Hansen's commentary. We'll see you back here soon. For Victor Davis Hansen and the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.